For many years, a diagnosis of lung cancer pretty much sounded like a death sentence. And while it's still a very serious condition, there have been advances in detection. There have been advances in treatment. And I think, you know, they offer some hope to those who are living with it. Hi, Larry Mueller here. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Dr. Toby Campbell is my guest today. He's a member of the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center. He's also an assistant professor in hematology, oncology, in that section of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Campbell, thanks for joining us today. Great to have you with us. Appreciate it very much.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I tell you, the number of people, well, let me change that a bit. How many people in the U.S. are diagnosed with lung cancer every year?
Each year, it's about 220,000 people. So, Larry, it affects a lot of people.
Wow. And is, we talk about lung cancer, I think of it as, all right, lung cancer, one thing. Is there more than one type?
Our understanding of lung cancer is growing, especially quickly over the last decade. So there are now, while lung cancer is still lung cancer and the disease remains the same, we understand quite a bit more about the subtypes of lung cancer. So it's fair to say that there are some distinctions in the diagnosis now. We used to just call them non-small cells and small cells. And now within that non-small cell category, there's actually probably, I'm just counting in my head quickly, probably some 10 to 15 different subtypes that we've identified.
Yeah.
You know, all of them, with a few rare exceptions, still equal a devastating disease.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very miserable, miserable disease to have, for sure.
It's a disease which both is life-threatening, but also causes a lot of symptoms. So people with lung cancer have shortness of breath and pain, and they have trouble with appetite. So it really affects both the patient, but also their whole family and support network.
What's the life expectancy of someone with lung cancer?
So in 2012, if you're diagnosed with lung cancer that, let's say, hasn't spread to the brain, which is a particularly devastating piece of the disease, the life expectancy on average is about a year.
Wow. So not a lot of hope then. I mean, that's pretty much it.
Most people with lung cancer will succumb to the disease.
Yeah. So what causes it? We know smoking certainly is tied with it.
Sure. Smoking is probably the number one, or not probably, smoking is the number one cause of lung cancer, but there are many others. In the United States, each year, approximately 20,000 people will be diagnosed with lung cancer who never smoked. Mm-hmm. In those never smokers, there certainly are genetic risk factors. There are other exposures, things like radon, for example, which is the second most common cause. Other things that we're exposed to. Our lungs are obviously out in the world, breathing in everything that we walk through and are exposed to. So there are other exposures.
It was amazing to me. A professor on the UW-Madison campus, Bob Niedermeyer, who never smoked, and I don't think he drank, he was a clean living sort of guy, died of lung cancer, and it was a very sad death for one of the really nice guys. Yeah, and never smoked.
I have so many wonderful patients and wonderful families who are going through a really, really difficult struggle. It's a disease which seems to affect a lot of wonderful people.
Yeah, there is a stigma attached to having it that people with other types of cancer don't face, I think, though, because of the smoking, isn't it?
You know, but I think that's absolutely true. Smoking cessation is an important part of any lung cancer control program. One of the reasons we've started to see the lung cancer rates, at least in men, fall or begin to fall. But it is universal that a patient who's diagnosed with lung cancer comes back to see me and says, you know, everybody always says, first thing out of my mouth when I tell them that I have lung cancer is, well, you smoked, didn't you? You know, my perception of that is that that is something that helps those of us without cancer cope. You know, you see someone who gets a devastating disease and you say to them, oh, well, you must have smoked. And in some ways, that's releasing us of the risk that that might happen to us or to someone we know. And I, you know, when my patients sort of, you have to sort of step into someone else's shoes and realize that they're scared as well. And, you know, that's probably a normal reaction. I hope this doesn't happen to me.
Yeah. Dr. Mike Fiore has been a guest on my show many times, and he says, always says, well, you know what? If you smoke, you can quit, and your lungs start repairing themselves almost right away, or probably right away.
That's true, and the risk for lung cancer goes down as well after stopping smoking. So it's a very important piece to reducing your risk for getting lung cancer.
Now, if you can stay off of cigarettes for 15 years or 20 years, you're probably close to having the same sort of chance of having lung cancer as somebody who never smoked.
It's true that it improves quickly. The stat that we typically quote is 30 years after 30 years? Stopping is when you're back to your baseline risk, the risk that everybody faces, that a non-smoker would face. So it takes a while to mitigate that risk, but it begins to fall right away.
Yeah. So our guest today, Dr. Toby Campbell, a member of the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center. Great to have him along to talk about lung cancer, and we certainly invite your questions as we visit with him. You can call us, and I see people already have, at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. Facebook comment asked that the Carbone Cancer Center be explained a little more, since it could actually sound a little like a type of cancer, and I'm privileged to say that I knew Paul Carbone and had him on this program, as a matter of fact, many, many years ago. But maybe we can talk a little bit about it.
Sure. The Carbone Cancer Center is named after Paul Carbone, an important figure in our history. So, you know, not a company or a donor, but rather an important figure in terms of cancer research and in terms of our development here at the University of Wisconsin. There are a relatively small number, approximately 40 comprehensive or cancer centers designated by the National Cancer Institute in Washington, and the UW is privileged to be one of even more special distinction of comprehensive cancer centers. So this really is a federal designation that just signifies that our cancer center provides comprehensive care, which includes everything from prevention to treatment to survivorship, end-of-life care, the whole spectrum of cancer-related illness.
And it's great that it's named after Paul. He was a wonderful man and a brilliant researcher. Jeanette in La Crosse, thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. As a side note, I just wanted to say that I noticed that lung cancer has, indirectly smoking, has taken a lot of really wonderful people too soon from this world, like maybe Nat King Cole. I think he died of that. And one of the Surgeon Generals, I believe, said that it's one of the few products when you use as directed causes disease and death. And who else gets away with that? But anyway, that's a side note. But I was calling because this might be helpful to some of the other people out there. My dad, when he was 80, he started getting confused as he got a little older, and we thought, well, maybe something like dementia of some sort. And then he got a little touch of pneumonia and went in, and they saw a tiny little spot on his lung that she almost couldn't notice. And so the doctor thought, I wonder. So she did an MRI and found his brain was full of cancer, and that tiny little dot had already taking over basically his brain, and so we didn't have him much longer than that. But I thought maybe that would be helpful if people, when someone, my dad spoke for back in the 40s and 50s when it was considered healthy, or cool or whatever, and I just thought that might be helpful. Some people, when they see an elderly person getting confused, it may not be what you think.
Good points, Dr. Campbell. Comment?
You know, it's hard to hear your story. Lung cancer affects so many different lives in really powerful and dramatic ways that stick with you for a long time. There are lots of causes of confusion, and I hear what you're saying. Occasionally, that's going to be something dramatic and serious like lung cancer. Certainly, that's not the most common cause of confusion as we get older. But, in consultation with your doctor, I think thinking about those unusual things is certainly important.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jeanette. Appreciate your call. Edward in Juneau, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yeah, I've been diagnosed with lung cancer. I'm going in next Friday. to have my left lower lobe of my left lung removed. I'm concerned. Is they told me I was working towards a cure from this, that it will go away and be gone. And I heard you say before that most people with lung cancer die within a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Edward, that's an important point. So there are a group of patients, though, who can be cured from lung cancer, and it really is most important for those who have tumors that can be removed. Surgery is your best bet for achieving a cure. So the five-year survival rate from lung cancer in 2012 is about 15%. So those are patients who are cured from the disease, most of those from surgery. So And in lung cancer is not a disease that we operate on unless we are as sure as we can be that we're going to be able to, quote-unquote, get it all out. So surgery, if they're offering it, is hopefully a great move for you, and I hope that goes well.
Yeah. Something to be positive about, Edward.
Yeah, I got lucky. I went in to have a colonoscopy done, and I had some air escape into my abdomen, and they just happened to see a little spot in my lung when they were looking for the air. And so, they got when it's only about an inch big.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, interestingly, Edward, a lot of patients who are found with potentially curable disease are found that way, incidentally. They got in a car accident, got a chest x-ray, something else happened. And this led to multiple studies across the U.S. and the world looking to see if we could find lung cancers when they were earlier and potentially curable. 19,000 plus Wisconsinites participated in the most recent trial called the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial, which did show that CT screening, low-dose CTs, were able to reduce the death rate from lung cancer by about 20%.
Wow.
So there is some suggestion that early detection is possible when you can find these cancers at an intervenable stage.
Good luck with your surgery, Edward.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Pete in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Toby. When Larry has on these home improvement guys, we're always trying to get the radon levels in the home down to less than 4 picocuries per liter, I think the rating is. And what I've read, and I'm looking for your input on this, is that rating is actually, probably pretty safe for non-smokers, but on the risky side for smokers because of the cumulative effect of the two hazards. Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
That's a great question, Pete, and I'm not sure that there has been a clear characterization of a dose response for risk for lung cancer. It's certainly true that there is one. It's just, what's the dose that begins to develop lung cancer, and is that dose different in people who smoke? I think that a wise and prudent, if not conservative, move is just to limit your exposure. And if your exposure, and if you are a smoker, it's probably wise to not add risk factors. So if you have one risk factor for lung cancer in smoking, and you have another in radon, I think those aren't multiplicative, but they certainly are additive in some way.
Yeah.
And so I think it's prudent to be careful.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Pete. Ellen in Brookfield. Hello.
Hi. I have a few things. My husband just died in March from lung cancer, and a diagnosis seems to be very difficult very often for this. You see something that looks strange in a lung, and nobody seems to, it doesn't seem to get pursued because his didn't look normal. So, first of all, diagnosis, I think, is pretty tough. The other thing is I am about ready to blow my stack at anybody who, again, says, well, he was a smoker. He was, and it irritated me. But in 35 years, he tried 13 times at least to quit using, Shantex and patches and you name it, and he couldn't. It is an addiction, plain and simple, and if people don't understand addiction, they need to learn to because it's everywhere. It is subsidized through the agriculture department. It's advertised and it would never pass FDA today. And it is something that goes after kids. And, if you start when you're 12 or 13 or 14, odds are they've got you for a lifetime. And the other thing, he's on chemo and radiation concurrently. He got through with that. It had metastasized further. He was on chemo and radiation for 12 of 13 months, or chemo or radiation. And I don't know if there's any way a person can try and stay healthy and not get it. So there is no place safe to be in the world to protect you from lung cancer. It is the ugliest, most god-awful, painful way to go. And is there anything that's on the horizon? And we went to MD Anderson. There are some trials, which, by the way, aren't free, and people need to know that, too.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just in too bad a shape. But I don't know if there's anything that you can talk about advice-wise and safety-wise and health-wise, you know, other than the smoking. But again, many, many people, we have a neighbor whose wife died of lung cancer, who had absolutely no history that would indicate it. And, you know, she had about as much time as my husband had.
Yeah.
Sure. I can hear the hurt in your voice, Ellen. It's a difficult,
I can too.
Difficult thing to go through for, obviously, for your husband, but for you as well.
And absolutely.
Probably multiple members of your family. And I can hear also that you tried really hard to find things that would help, that would help him to be around longer. So there, I think, are several things which have been interesting over the last few decades that give us more time with our loved ones and give us hope that we'll continue to make treatments better. A few things that I'll point out. One is that we certainly have a better understanding of how lung cancer cells tick. Now, this is the place where we need to work the hardest so that we have better, more focused treatments. We call them targeted, more targeted treatments to treat these cancers better without pounding the person who's carrying the cancer around. Typical chemotherapies, you know, make you lose your hair and you get nauseous and all of those things. And some of our targeted treatments, while they certainly have side effects, are more focused and oftentimes more effective. So we have some of those targeted treatments for lung cancer. They are applicable only to a small fraction of patients with lung cancer, unfortunately. But this is the place where developments have taken place and they need to continue to take place. And that's where most of the work is today. In addition, I would mention that it's also been shown that just taking good care of people, managing their symptoms well, providing what we call palliative care, so from an old, I believe, Latin term, palliare, meaning to cloak or cover, to treat the symptoms well. There was a recent study published that showed that good palliative care starting at the time of diagnosis prolonged life actually by as much as additional rounds of chemotherapy.
Wow.
About 3 months. We recently completed a study here at the UW that showed a similar effect. So it's just true that doing a good job managing people's symptoms also helps.
Plus, I mean, the person who has it, it's got to be a much better end-of-life story for them.
Well, I certainly hope so. I think that, you know, I would hope that whether or not palliative care providers or whether the oncologist is doing palliative care themselves, which is certainly appropriate and possible, I'd like to think that we can help patients with cancer, whether it's lung cancer or other, get to their end of their life with grace and dignity and have them have the experience that they deserve.
Dr. Toby Campbell, member of the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in about 20 minutes or so, a little less, we'll be talking about organ transplants and organ donation with Dr. Tony D'Alessandro. Looking forward to that. Right now, I'm really happy to have Dr. Toby Campbell with us, who is a assistant professor in the hematology oncology section of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, a member of the UW Carbone Cancer Center, to talk with us about lung cancer prevention, detection, and treatment. Certainly great to have him along, and thank you for listening in. Lots of callers online. I'm wondering about detection. I've had a few calls here from people who say, well, just by luck, we, you know, saw this little spot and we were able to, you know, have something happen. So you wonder, you know, by the time you're aware that something's wrong, is it already too late?
Often that's the case, although I was just alluding to a study called the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial, which showed a 20% reduction in mortality, so deaths related to lung cancer, because of early detection. This involved a low-dose CT scan at three time points, 1 year apart. This was the first trial that showed a true benefit, meaning people lived longer.
Yeah.
Because we found the cancers when they were potentially curable. Now, there's mixed things here, Larry, because this study found lots and lots of nodules that were not cancer.
Yeah.
In fact, more than 96% of the positive CT scans were falsely positive, meaning that they weren't lung cancer. So it's true that you had to screen 320 people to prevent one lung cancer-related death. Just to put that in context, though, mammogram, which is routinely accepted, that number is 1,900 to 1.
Uh-huh.
So prostate cancer with PSA screening, 1,400 to 1. So the lung cancer screening actually is certainly solid in terms of data if you compare it. But this still begs the question, and it still is important to note that, take breast cancer, for example. The breast is on the outside of the body. If you find a positive result, you need to biopsy it. There's relatively low risk to that. There's certainly emotional consequences, but you're not going to, in general, harm someone with medical misadventure irreparably versus biopsying someone's lung, for example, where there can be true harm. So it's mixed. While we can reduce mortality, it comes with a lot of emotional baggage, and also physical risk.
Yeah, there you go. We have Dan, who lives in Virginia, who joins us. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Just two things I wanted to bring up. My brother-in-law was a smoker his entire life, and my sister got him and herself to quit smoking in 1985. And he stayed around to 2005. And my current wife, they discovered cancer in her left lung and treated it with chemo and with radiation. And this May will be 4 years after eradicating everything.
That's great.
That is really, really wonderful. And she's not a smoker?
Actually, she is.
Mm-hmm.
She was beforehand, and she still is.
She still is.
Yeah. Every year, she goes in and gets a PET scan, and so far it's been cleaned completely, 100%.
Well, that's good. That is very good news.
But it points out to an earlier caller's point about the addictive nature of tobacco and cigarettes and nicotine, and even someone who has faced a potentially life-ending illness with lung cancer still has trouble quitting smoking. I mean, it's true that this is just a really addictive substance, and as the earlier caller said, it's a disease.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan, thanks so much for calling and sharing that with us.
You're quite welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Chris in Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I got a question about linking marijuana smoking to lung cancer, and my couple of questions are, has there been a study? Did the study control for marijuana cultivated with pesticides or not? And then the black resin that collects on the inside of the pipe, can I assume, or should I assume, that that's also a resin that's collecting on the inside of my lungs?
Boy, Chris, a couple of great questions that I, I'm going to guess at, but don't really know the answers. I am not aware of a study linking marijuana smoking to lung cancer. Let me say that causation for cancer is difficult to establish. I mean, it took the medical community decades to establish the link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And here we have a dose response. We can ask people how many packs a day you smoke. So we have a good sense of the exposure, and that translates into risk, and we were eventually able to establish that link. But, it's much more difficult to establish a marijuana link for lung cancer because it's illegal, so people are not as willing to disclose. The dose-response relationship is more difficult to establish. So I'm not aware. I would say, though, that the resin that builds up in the pipe is likely to be going into the lungs as well. So I think the answer to that latter question is probably yes.
There you go. Phyllis in Clark County. Hi.
Yes. My husband was diagnosed with lung cancer 5.5 years ago. He had surgery, chemo, and radiation. And my concern has to do with the outcomes from the treatment, because he's suffering, from the shortness of breath and from a neuropathy in his legs and his fingers and lack of appetite, and now, of course, more and more body weakness. And the concern is that when they do follow up, the follow up simply has to do with an X-ray or a scan, and they'll say no visible sign of reoccurring cancer, which we're happy to hear. However, it doesn't seem as though the side effects from the treatments are being addressed very well. And we're always looking for help with that and not getting much. Could you tell me more about that?
Sure. Phyllis, it sounds like you and he are both struggling. Let's say that it's, and I don't know all the details about your husband, but let's imagine that he had already some underlying lung disease prior to his diagnosis of lung cancer, and then we further assaulted his lungs with from intense treatment, surgery, followed by chemo and radiation. All of this is going to manifest more lung disease, more shortness of breath. So here you've traded, it sounds like a near cure, if not probably a cure, from this deadly disease, but you're left with some probably lifelong disability, both from the disease, but also from the treatment, very clearly.
The
body doesn't grow new lung. And so it may well be, Phyllis, that, that the symptoms that he has now and his limitations for functional capacity because of shortness of breath are probably permanent.
Mm.
And there may well be some things to do to help ease the shortness of breath. But I think the reason you may not be getting much response from the docs is they are probably limited in terms of what they can do to help him function more.
And I suppose the issue of trying to sort of build yourself up by more exercise in ways, you're probably, it's hard to do because you're short of breath and so forth, but can that have a positive impact?
Absolutely. I mean, much like someone who's training for a race, you know, you build your endurance up and you can run farther, you can run faster. That's also true in people with advanced disease, but you're right, it's harder to get yourself there. But certainly it will help to preserve more function. I guess I would say a prescribed exercise program that you've put together with a rehab specialist or a physical therapist so that you know you're sort of on safe ground. But absolutely, that could be beneficial in a variety of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Phyllis.
Then,
go ahead.
And then the other thing is that he has neuropathy in his feet. And they said, well, this will pass in 6 months. Well, this will pass in a year. Well, it's been 5.5 years, and it hasn't really. And they've given him several medications. One was an antidepressant off-label use for that, which had little effect. And now I think it's gabapentin, which again seems to have little effect on that. And I just wonder if there's other options.
Phyllis, does he have pain or just numbness and tingling?
Numbness and tingling, and yeah. And it does, it has receded. It's just simply in his feet, you know, now, where before it was up to his knees.
Okay.
But it's taken 5.5 years for that to happen.
Sure. And Phyllis, I hate to keep saying this, he may be stuck with some of that too. Chemotherapy does cause nerve injury. So do a variety of other conditions. So he, you know, perhaps he's got a couple of things contributing, but it could just be the chemotherapy. And it is also fair to say that we don't have treatments which are effective for that numbness tingling. We have some things, like you mentioned the gabapentin, you mentioned an antidepressant. Those really are meant for painful neuropathy. And there has been some effect in terms of some patients will have improved pain. But I'm not aware that they really help that numbness tingling, which is, you know, can be really disabling and probably further limit his activity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Phyllis,
is there discussion about alternative medicines like acupuncture and nutrition and those kinds of things?
That's a great question, Phyllis. This chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy actually happens to be one of my research areas, so I'm very up to speed on what's going on. And the short answer is yes, people are exploring all kinds of different options. When we look at these things, though, it takes a number of patients to find one for whom it works. So it's certainly worth trying. Acupuncture might work for your husband, but it may well not. And it's just a process, I guess, of trial and error.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is not something you find something that works for.
Yeah. Phyllis, again, I thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Ben who wonders the drug in trial now called Stimivax, LBLP25. Does that show any promise, or are you aware of that particular drug in trial?
So let me generalize a little bit. There have been multiple vaccine trials looking at patients with a variety of cancers. And lung cancer, because it is often a very heterogeneous mix of cells, so the cells have lots of different genetic mutations, vaccines have not been particularly effective. Not been effective at all, except the field is starting to look at it in a preventative strategy. So for patients who've had their cancer removed, and if they have any left, it would just be microscopic. There, the possibility that stimulating the immune system to fight cancer could be potentially more effective. Some of the newer vaccine trials are doing things a little bit more exotic, I suppose, by taking some of the cancer cells and trying to culture them and stimulate the immune system even specifically against that individual's tumor cells. So there is some interesting vaccine research, although, to be truthful, I think the utility of these as a treatment is potentially impossible, if not very far away. But the utility of them as a preventative strategy or adjunctive or adjuvant is more biologically feasible.
There we go. Karen in Madison, hello.
Hello. I have two questions. The first one is, I lived in a pretty smoke-saturated environment until I was 31. My parents were both four-pack-a-day smokers when cigarettes were really strong, and ultimately my dad did die of lung cancer. I'm 61 now, and I'm in very poor health in general. I was wondering what my risk factors are right now for developing lung cancer.
So it's been 30 years, essentially.
Yes. Right.
Sort of mentioned earlier, Karen, I guess theoretically your risk is probably back to baseline, given that it's been 30 years. Now, it's true that secondhand smoke, I mentioned that 20,000 people each year who never smoked themselves are diagnosed with lung cancer. A significant percentage of those were exposed to secondhand smoke. So even in the never smokers, tobacco exposure, smoke exposure still contributes to risk. So I think that you probably did increase your risk or you had your risk increased for you. But after 30 years of being without exposure, your risk should be somewhere close to baseline.
There you go.
So there's no regular screening I should be getting?
The UW has a screening program, which is now open, but is for individuals who would have fit into that screening trial. So these are individuals between the age of 50 and 74 who have a heavy smoking history, more than 30 pack years. A pack year is if you smoke one pack per day for 1 year, that's a pack year. If your parents did four packs per day, that's each year you'd be a four pack year risk. So 30 pack year is considered a heavy smoker, and that's the population that would be eligible for our screening program.
Okay, and then I had one more quick question. As a nurse, I'd always heard that a dry, non-productive cough that just doesn't go away for months is a pretty simple but relevant sign for someone to go in and get screened. My dad had that for months before he got his brain cancer from the lung cancer. Isn't that something that could be emphasized more to people? Because it's really cheap and inexpensive and simple.
There's a lot of education that could help, I think, in detecting lung cancer. You know, a cough that persists for months warrants evaluation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. I got an email from Jilly, whose father died of lung cancer. I think it probably started in the prostate because of months of pain in that area. He saw many doctors, couldn't find a reason for the pain. He then had trouble breathing. They found what they thought was stage 2 in lung, and once they went in to remove it, they found it was stage 4. And he died 6 weeks later. Could this have started in the prostate and then moved to the lungs?
Great question, Jilly. I explained to my patients, because this is a really confusing point for a lot of people, if you have lung cancer and it spreads somewhere else like the bones or the liver, it is still lung cancer. It's just living somewhere else. As if you yourself moved to a new city, you're still yourself. You're just living in a different place. So could this have been prostate cancer that spread to the lungs? Yes, that is possible, although it is quite uncommon. Prostate cancer can do that, but rarely. So I'm not sure the exact specifics of whether your dad had lung cancer or prostate cancer. It's possible to have both, quite frankly.
Mary Ann from Bartlett, Illinois, wonders if you could discuss the link between asbestos exposure and lung cancer.
So asbestos exposure causes a particular kind of lung cancer called meso or mesothelioma. And that link is well established and very clear. And asbestos causes mesothelioma. There's a lag between the asbestos exposure and the development of cancer. It happens over a 20 to 50 year period of time generally. So oftentimes people cannot even remember the exposure because sometimes it was so long ago, or even sometimes minimal, or even patients don't know where their exposure was. But there is a link between asbestos and a specific kind of cancer called mesothelioma.
And an email from Rob in Winnebago says, I and many of my coworkers have long-term radon exposure. What should we and our primary care physicians be watching for as we age?
That's a good question, Rob. So even, you know, even with significant radon exposure, your risk of developing lung cancer is still low. So that's the good news.
Yeah.
It's probably higher than baseline, but it's still low. And so I would counsel you to continue to watch for symptoms like, for example, a chronic cough that someone mentioned earlier. Certainly worthwhile to talk to your doctor about any strategies that might be helpful for you individually. But screening programs, as I mentioned earlier, are not, well, for example, the screening program that I mentioned earlier is not yet recommended by any screening body. Any major screening body. This has not been adopted by insurance companies yet. It takes the community a little while to figure out the relationship of these things and the cost-benefit analysis. So there's not a screening program that I could recommend to you, but I think paying attention to your symptoms and working with your doctor would be important.
Absolutely. And for more, as we wind up here, Dr. Campbell, for more information on lung cancer websites, where's the best place to go?
Sure. I think there are a few good websites. There, the National Lung Cancer Partnership, with a simple Google search would find that is a good resource. They're actually a Madison-based national company. The Lung Cancer Alliance is another good organization. The Carbone Cancer Center website would be another source for quality information.
And we have that, and I think one of the other sites you mentioned up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Toby, I want to thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
That'd be a lot of fun. Thank you.
Love to have you back. Dr. Toby Campbell, member of the UW Carbone Cancer Center, also an assistant professor in the hematology oncology section at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He does a great job, doesn't he? Interesting and, I think, encouraging in many ways, a conversation about lung cancer. Coming up next, we'll learn about what conditions can be treated through organ donations and how we can register to be a donor. I'm registered. Are you? It's important information to have, so stay tuned right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.